It's Wednesday, August the 15th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. We are absolutely in the dog days, the doldrums of politics at this point in the middle of August. We are lining up a few interesting podcasts, or at least I hope you're going to find them interesting, on the broader subject of politics over the next couple of weeks. But I did drag in my colleagues, political reporter Sarah Barden and deputy political editor Fia Kelly, to run the rule over a very quiet political week. Sarah, you're very welcome back. It's a long time since you've been in the studio.
Thank you.
You had a nice time away.
Yes, great.
Great to be back, honestly.
Yeah.
She didn't miss one episode of the podcast. She was listening on her holiday.
You were on the beach listening every week.
Exactly.
Every week.
It's such an exciting time for politics at the minute, so I'm really happy that I'm here.
Indeed it is. Before we started recording here, we were talking about how much we had to talk about on the political scene, and it's a little bit like Seinfeld was famously described as a show about absolutely nothing. And in a way, this politics podcast today is that, Fiac, because there's not a lot going on.
No, I think this week is the probably one of the quietest news weeks of the year. People have stuff to tide them through the week after the August bank holiday weekend, and then the week after that people are still on their holidays and there's not much happening, and you have to wait for people to come back after holidays. So there isn't much happening on the political scene apart from I can't believe it's not a heave, Labour heave, which is seems to be going from weakness to weakness every passing day.
We talked about this in disparaging terms last week, but it's still there.
It's still there, and it's kind of funny. There seems to be a kind of drip of county councillors coming out saying that Brendan Howland needs to either go or open a discussion about his position. And because either he has not yet come out and said, I'm not going anywhere to stop this, or a member of the PP hasn't come out and said, this is nonsense, we need to stop it now, it just keeps continuing. And you just wonder that if it continues on for a number of weeks, will it become an issue when the political season really kicks back in September? Most people in the PP believe that the councillors are agitated and on edge because of the really bad polls in recent weeks, and they are the ones who are likely to face the electorate next, because the general election has kind of fallen back along the electoral timescale, and the local elections are next spring. And if you're a Labour Party councillor looking, as the last Behaviour and Attitudes poll for the Sunday Times had them on 3% behind the Independent Alliance and on 4% in Dublin, then you would have reason to be worried. And I think that's where the momentum, if there is any, is coming from. The kind of the involvement or otherwise of Alan Kelly is what most people are talking about within the parliamentary party. Is he involved, or is he just letting this play out?
And what do you think?
Initially, at the start, most people believed that he wasn't, that this just came from a couple of councillors who were panicked when they saw the polls. And most people there's split opinions in the PP. One member I spoke to last night said that didn't seem that he was behind it, but he was standing back and allowing it to happen. Like, he has been tweeting, he's been on social media, but he hasn't been answering his phone calls or texts from journalists, so he hasn't come out to stop it. Probably because these councillors would be naturally inclined to support him in a contest anyway, so he doesn't want to cut them off the knees now, and then they would remember it if there is a contest. So I think he's probably happy to see it play out and see where it goes. But as to his active involvement, I'm not quite sure yet.
What's the reality on the ground, whatever about the views of these councillors, Sarah, on Brendan Howland's leadership, whether in the Dáil or in media or the polls, as Fiac says? Traditionally, when a party gets a really serious knockback in an election, as Labour certainly did last time around, you hear a lot about how the leader, whether they be a new leader or not, the first thing they have to do is get out, you know, do the digging work, the spade work, to kind of reinvigorate the party at local level, find new candidates, do all that kind of stuff. Has Labour been managing to do that? Is there a fresh new slate of candidates coming through for the local elections?
He has done a national tour, and he has gone across the country to speak to councillors and stuff. I think the difficulty for them is more in a national perspective. So while they may make some minor grounds, you know, local level, they're being eclipsed on the national scale. So, you know, the Social Democrats, the Green Party and the Labour Party are all fighting for the same
centre-left vote.
Exactly. And it's very difficult for the Labour Party to identify differently than the Social Democrats and the Green Party, because essentially, you know, they're all fighting for the same vote. What's happening now, in a way, is almost a little bit too late. Like, the Labour Party, for, you know, are not making any ground in the opinion polls. And if I was a member of the Labour Party or a supporter of the Labour Party, I'd certainly be questioning what needs to change. But the difficulty for them is where do they turn? And the same problem arises for them that arose when Joan Burton stood aside as party leader. It's that Alan Kelly does not have the support of the parliamentary party, and they believe that he's very hot-headed, ill-tempered at times, and they don't necessarily believe that that's the person that should be leading them into a general election.
And there's no other option in the admittedly rather small parliamentary party, or TDs to be more precise, just the parliamentary party,
it has to be a TD. A TD, and that's the difficulty for them, because a lot of people would believe that someone like Éan O'Riordan or even Jed Nash could potentially have some leadership material. But unfortunately for them, they have to elect a TD. So their emphasis is really going into electing people like Jed Nash and Éan O'Riordan, and ensuring that they make some ground in the next general election, and then looking at a lead. That's
Brendan Howland is essentially a placeholder.
He's essentially there.
Which in itself can't be great if you're trying to reinvigorate the party, if that's a sense around
him. In fairness to Brendan, I mean, when we had him in here, a couple of months ago, I mean, I think he identifies that is his role, is that he's there to steady the ship, he's there to calm the troops and to take Labour through what they would describe as a period of reflection. But no doubt that there are plenty of councillors across the country, and you know, Fiacc's been writing about it a lot over the last couple of weeks, that are getting nervous and anxious because it's not going anywhere for them. Brendan Howland would argue that it's going to, you know, Fianna Fáil had 5 years to do it, and the Labour Party needs similar time periods too, but they don't have the luxury of time. While the general election talk has abated and it's unlikely to take place this year or early next year, it looks, the local elections are coming, and in order for the Labour Party to grow, they need to make gains at the local local electoral level. And if they don't do that, then what is the future of the
Labour Party? And Fiacc, Sarah mentioned Éan O'Riordan, who seems to be the heir apparent, either himself or Jed Nash, if he gets re-elected to the Dáil from Louth. Éan O'Riordan had an op-ed piece in the Irish Times today, or a couple of days ago, where he was sort of attempting to address some of these questions about what Sarah's referring to, these kind of, you know, all these small parties, including Labour, competing in this small centre-left pool, and what might be done about that?
Yeah, he raised the prospect of cooperation between the Greens, Social Democrats and the Labour Party, and others who may be of that political persuasion. The unfortunate thing is that's extremely unlikely to happen. While you could see some coordination between the Greens, for example, and the Labour Party, although there are constituencies where they're at each other's throat, and we're talking about electoral rivalry, like if you look at Dublin Bay South, you have Kevin Humphreys, who is vying to take back his seat, and Eamon Ryan is occupying that centre-left space now in the Dáil for that constituency. So there are difficulties there. But it is hard to see any kind of cooperation between the Social Democrats and Labour. There is just too much animosity between the players at the top.
Is this
both
just
parties
about the top? Is it about Roisin Shorthall versus the current parliamentary party?
Probably,
or is it
not,
about
because if you look at like the Social Democrats, they're activist base, their recent recruits are all much younger people who 10 years ago may have been going towards the Labour Party. So there's probably a view in the Social Democrats that we are the coming centre-left, I wouldn't say force, but we're the coming centre-left movement. We are eating into the Labour Party on an activist level, on a membership level, so why would we give them the kiss of life?
And are they right about that in terms of numbers, do you know?
In terms of numbers, not quite sure, but they are probably the party that has reaped the most benefit from, say, people who came involved in marriage equality and repeal the eight. That's where that effort is going into the Social Democrats. Because, let's face it, they haven't been tainted by the experience of government. They're relative clean skins. So I think they are seen as an attractive option. And they are a party that has a much more modern face. Like, the Social Democrats, of all the parties, curiously are having difficulties with their gender balance, but they're having difficulties completely opposite to what the other parties have. They have too many women.
They may not have 30% men, so
they are very much a party of the moment, if you like, of a certain time and place, and they are probably looking at the Labour Party going, why would we do this, why would we give them a kiss of life? Now that may change after a general election. I can't see it happening before a general election, but if they were to kind of form a caucus of 10 to 12 seats and make themselves really key players in any government formation talks,
the
then it could happen.
The same difficulty arises for the Social Democrats this time round as it has done last time round. Catherine Murphy and Roisin Shorthall will probably always be re-elected in their individual constituencies because they're very influential TDs in their own right. But they need to make gains. I mean, yes, they have seen us from my understanding, is they have seen a significant increase in their membership since particularly the referendum, because they were very ground level based, and you know, canvassed quite strongly for repealing the Eighth Amendment. But the same problem arises for them. You know, where do the Social Democrats make gains? Where do they have their TDs elected?
Sure. I mean, we've heard them. We've had one or two of them in the studio here. You know, they're very, very presentable new faces in constituencies like Dunleary and a couple of other, you know, constituencies around Dublin.
Most are looking at 3 or 4 seats. Like, yeah. They have two. They'd be doing really well to put on one or two extra. Really well to put on two. Yeah.
Can I ask you something about this? And maybe this is my naivety, not being outside the political bubble which you guys inhabit so well. But the main issue that the people who defected from Labour or stopped voting for Labour had with Labour was not on these kind of identity issues which you've just talked about, which are the most identifiable things about the Social Democrats, these new candidates, the identification with social liberalism, the last two referendums, that kind of stuff. It was about them buying into what people on the left characterise as austerity policies. And what role does economic politics play in this? And does Labour need to shift in terms of its policies on things like free education, universal healthcare, higher taxation, all those kind of things? Does it need to move on
those? I think that's actually a really mature way of looking at things, but I don't think that's why the Labour Party have suffered in the way that they have. They suffered because they were seen, rightly or wrongly, as the characteristic of broken promises in the last gen. So in 2011, they believed that they could be the largest party in Leinster House, and they made a series of promises to voters, identifiable to a large cohort of voters. You know, no cutting child benefit, no increase in student fees, these things that really the Labour Party have always fought for. And when they went into power, they reversed those key positions for them. Now, they will say it was absolutely necessary. It was a time of austerity. When they went in, they realised it was way worse than they had.
But they shouldn't have made those promises in the first place. The hubris of Eamon Gilmore and the people
around him. Regardless of whether they should
have
made them or not, that's what people identify the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. That's why they suffered as much as they did in 2016. And can they come back from that?
And that kind of speaks very much to the conflict at the heart of the Labour Party. They see themselves as being, you know, a centre-left party, but the party that takes responsibility for government, that is willing to enter government. Like, Éan O'Riordan made that point in his op-ed on Monday, that, you know, we are the party who are most likely to be courted by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, because we are the ones who will enter government and can act as a party of government. And I think that's the conflict that was probably Labour's undoing, as Sarah said, is that if you speak to people who were around the party, at the top of the party, at that time in 2011, they say, yes, we kind of knew that the promises we were making were unlikely to be fulfilled in the whole, but we believed that we had a responsibility to get in there and
I've heard all that again and again and again, but one of the things that was interesting about Éan O'Riordan's piece this week, I thought, was he seemed to say that they needed to put the sackcloth and ashes still on a little bit more. They needed to come out and say, we specifically made mistakes here, we specifically betrayed or didn't fulfil promises which we made to the electorate, and we need to fess up better on that.
Jack O'Connor, who's now the party's chairman, says the same thing, that we need to do a full review of how we operated during that period between 11 and 16 and even the 16 election. He says that needs to be done, and it needs to be seen to be done by the public, so we can come out and say, yes, we made mistakes, we've learned, and now we can move on.
Yeah.
I think there is probably an appetite for that, but the problem with that is if you open up that debate, and Éan O'Riordan talks about this debate, Jack O'Connor's talking about this debate, how do you quarantine that from the issue of Brendan Howland as the party leader? Like, it's a very difficult period they're going into.
Yeah, and I think the problem for them as well is that, you know, for those of us who observe Leinster House on a daily basis, Brendan Howland is constantly reminding us that he was Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, and Alan Kelly reminds us often too that he was once Minister for the Environment. So if you're constantly harping on to a time when you were in government, even though it seems to have been at your peril, people will continuously link you with that period in time. So the more that the Labour Party talk about their time in government, the more they will suffer. Like, realistically, people associate Joan Burton and Brendan Howland with an era of austerity and cutbacks, and that's the problem for them. They can't unchain
and
that.
The personalities in the parliamentary party don't help. So one of them said to me, look, being realistic, you turn on your radio on a Saturday afternoon or an evening when you're driving home in your car and you hear a current affairs debate, and who is representing the Labour Party? Brendan Howland, Joan Burton, and there are people of a different era, and you are reminded of that era. It would be a lot easier for them if they had a younger cohort of people in there who could step up on a national level. They just don't have that, and I think they were really unfortunate in how the last election turned out for them, and that the people they ideally, if they were to renew the party, could do with, I'm not saying could do with losing seats, but if they were to have the same net figure of 7 in the
parliament. Different faces.
Different faces, and that was really, really unfortunate for them.
Right, well, moving on to this jam-packed political agenda this week. You know, we've very well-read listeners. I'm sure some of them are on the beach at the moment, are reading various tomes of philosophy and, you know, high politics, and they will all be familiar with the French writer Jean Baudrillard, who made the point, and I quote, "Human experience is a simulation of reality," and that seems like an appropriate way to think of the current presidential contest. Fear.
God, I didn't know where we were going there. Okay.
I suppose so. There's about as much happening in the presidential contest as there is in politics generally.
It's this
at the moment.
Kind of. I refuse to use the phrase fake news, but it is this sort of artificial construct. It's like a pretend political contest rather than a real
like
one.
Even like the councils are hearing out the aspirant candidates at the moment, but there's nothing they can do because they can't actually pass a motion backing X candidate or Y candidate until the presidential order is signed. So
when does that happen?
That would happen, I think, in September, early September.
Okay.
So there'll be
they have to officially declare that the date of the presidential election is
definitely declared. So it'll be like. Yeah. There'll be basically a month of people trying to get onto the ticket and then a month of actual campaigning when the candidates are finalised. So we're in that kind of strange space at the moment. And I suppose the reason it's kind of still a bit fake is because we've yet to see how Michael Dee is going to perform or Michael Dee is going to approach the campaign, and that will set the tone for everything else, that everybody's waiting to define themselves against Michael Dee or to see what Michael Dee's doing.
Well, he's out and about a fair bit.
He's out and about, but he's done really very little in terms of
He's against
strategy.
Gambling and against gambling and advertising and sports
and bad things generally, and likes a bit of ground hurling, as he told RT in the day of the hurling final. But apart from that, we don't. You know, there is a kind of a bit of a effort to bring his expenses into the debate. You know,
who's trying to bring that in?
I think Pádraig O'Cadogh was the first person to start it. Pádraig O'Cadogh, who still is yet to make up his mind whether he's actually running or not. Mm. He did an interview in the Sunday Independent a week or two ago, in which he said that President Higgins should publish his medical records and his expenses. And there has been some coverage about, you know, the president staying in a hotel in Geneva and how much did it cost the taxpayer, etc., etc., etc. Obviously, the president's expenditure is completely outside the remit of freedom of information, so nobody knows.
Well, you say obviously, but why is that?
Because it was just part of the initial freedom of information legislation when it was passed. I don't know the rationale for it, but it's just always been accepted.
Well, I actually, I was writing about this yesterday, and I started to wonder why was it exempt from freedom of information, you know, and was it because Brendan Howland was introducing the legislation and Michael D. Higgins, you know, you start to have all these conspiracy theories. So I contacted someone who pointed me to Article 13.81 of the Constitution.
Oh, yes. Always at work. Very good.
Says that the office of president shall not be answerable to either houses of the Oireachtas or to any court for the exercise and performance of the powers and functions of his office.
Okay.
So I don't know if, and I spoke to David Kenny, who's a constitutional expert in UCD, and I spoke to him this morning, and it's not quite clear whether freedom of information legislation can be introduced in line with what that constitutional clause says. So I think you could make cases basically on
either
both
way,
sides.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's as clear cut as people think it's going to be. But one thing is absolutely sure from the reading of that is that this notion that the Public Accounts Committee is going to have remit over the presidential expenses, it's completely unconstitutional, but unfortunately.
Well, I think we could all accept that, but it seems perfectly reasonable to me that we should be able to see how our money's being spent on the presidency.
I think we do. I think there's headline figures in the CNAG's report every year about the cost of the office, but I don't think what...
Yeah, you'll be able to see that 30 million euro has been given to the president's... or to Arsene Luke Throne for the last 7 years, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to see where that money was...
And what about this issue of health? We know they have this fantastic system in the States where Donald Trump's doctor pronounces him, I think, the healthiest man ever to have lived, you know? I mean, should we not be looking for the same kind of evidence in relation to Michael Dee?
He was asked the question directly a week or two ago and didn't answer it. Just said, "I'm in the best health I've ever been. You know, I'm really healthy. I did have an issue with my leg a couple of years ago, but now I'm fine." Didn't directly answer the question of whether he would publish his medical records. It's kind of a funny one because a bit like the expenses one, it's a kind of underhand way of getting at Michael Dee. Like, we don't have a tradition, as you say, of this like kind of full exposure of your medical records. I'm not sure people would really want to see your medical records. But it's a way of kind of going nudge, nudge, wink, wink. He's really old, isn't he? And is he going to be able to be there for 7 years? Same thing. And the expenses thing is something similar. Like, Michael D will be reluctant, as I understand it, to publish his expenses. It would be very much at the last, and if he's under extreme pressure, he would do so. But I don't think he will. But it's a way of saying, in a way, he's damned if he does, and he's damned if he doesn't. If he doesn't, he'll look like he has something to hide. If he does, you know, he'll come out that he's stayed in nice hotels for the last 7 years. But of course, he is the president of Ireland. That's the way the office operates.
But we do know that Michael D, that there will be a contest, and that Michael D Higgins will be the first president to actively campaign while sitting in the office, because De Valera didn't do that in 1966. And we also know that these presidential contests, when they happen, tend to get down and dirty and pretty personal.
Yeah, they're a bit of a bear pit, really. You know, the last presidential election was brutal, and I think Fiac won an award, a journalism award, for his coverage of the presidential election last time round. But
fond memories, Fiac.
There's a tear to my eye.
They are brutal, to say the least. And I think what you've seen over the last number of weeks is that there's very few sticks to beat Michael D Higgins with. He's fought an election in 2011 and he escaped it relatively unharmed. He's had a good 7 year tenure. People are fond of him, particularly young people. So if you're a budding presidential candidate and you're looking at what potentially, you know, how can I make hay, you look at Michael D's age and you look at the issue of expenses. Now, I think the issue of age doesn't necessarily, I think, play a key factor in it. I spoke recently on this podcast about how I was at an event in Smithfield and he was there and he shook the hands of about 2,500 people. And I swear he's more energy than all five.
Yeah, no, I've seen that too, to be fair.
The age thing is also a way of reminding people that he promised he'd only run for one term.
It's a way of resonating with people. Yeah. Anecdotal was at my nanny's house recently, and she had all her friends over, and they were like, "We love Michael D, but he said he'd only go for one term." Yeah. And it's actually,
I hope Sarah's nanny isn't listening to this podcast.
She doesn't even know what a podcast is.
Sarah can pronounce on the constitutional niceties, and the next thing you know, we're with her nana. That's great.
Well, we haven't gone to the level of Naggins yet, so which we did last time on a podcast, so we'll get there. But I think that is resonating with people, but people are just so fond of Michael D Higgins. So I think if you were a budding presidential candidate, do you want to get down and dirty against the president? I don't know.
But
so what I think they're doing is beating around the bush.
A crowded field, but if there's four or five candidates, you might want one of the other candidates to do it.
Yeah,
absolutely. You don't want to do it, but you wouldn't mind somebody else doing it.
It hasn't gone unnoticed that Jared Crockwell, who is not running for president, is still out contributing to debate and raising questions about President Higgins and the expenses incurred in his office. So, you know, it's no harm to have someone like Jared Crockwell in there beating as Sarah says, raising questions and poking.
And so looking at it now, I mean, who are we likely to have in the field, Sarah?
Well, it seems like Gavin Duffy already, believes that he's a presidential nominee. He's got a campaign office in Drogheda. He had posters up for the FLAF.
Had
to take them down after
illegal posters. Should he be prosecuted for that, I wonder?
Well, he didn't seek permission and he put them up.
That's littering, as far as I know.
It is littering. So I'm sure Loud County Council will be all over him like a rash. But I think he's already presumed that he has the nomination. So maybe, maybe we don't know the numbers as well as he does. But I think Joan Freeman will get the nominations. I think if she doesn't get it by local authority level, I think independent DDs and senators will sign her nomination papers within the Oireachtas. I don't know if Kevin Sharkey will be as successful, but I am travelling to Carlo. We race in town to Carlo after this podcast to hear Mr. Sharkey and others address the Carlo County Council, so maybe have a better idea after that. And then, of course, we have the Sinn Féin candidate. So,
and we have Padraig O'Cady, just to say who.
Well, we don't yet know. He seems to kind of be still considering it. Like, he's yet to say yay or nay. And just looking at the potential candidates now, Gavin Duffy seems to be trying a lot. He's putting a lot of effort into it. He is going to meet in councillors. He's campaigning, as Sarah says. He's turning up at events. So he has to be taken as a serious candidate because he wants to get into the race. Joan Freeman has announced that she's running, but we haven't seen much by follow-up activity. She's speaking at the council today, but Duffy is quite visibly active. Joan Freeman isn't. O'Cady is neither. He's not turning up at this council today.
And
what about
Sean Gallagher?
He's still, someone I spoke to last night said he will always play a very active role in the campaign. My suspicion as of now is that he wants to run, but is keeping his powder dry, and so he can give himself the excuse of, I'm hanging back. I never made a declaration. I suspect that he may enter the race later But he's giving himself leeway to back out if he needs to.
I think he's quite enjoying this. You know, he's observing from the sidelines. Like he obviously issued that letter to all the local authorities encouraging them to use their constitutional right to nominate a candidate. But then he also wrote to the Minister for Housing and the chairperson of the Housing Committee about electoral leaflets. So, you know, under the electoral law, each candidate can send leaflets, you know, to householders, and he was saying it's a waste of money for each candidate, so why don't we all just put them on the one leaflet, you know? So he's almost involving himself but not declaring. So I think what we could potentially see happen is when we know who our candidates are, he'll come in at the last minute and announce his candidacy. But right now I think he's just sitting at the sidelines and quite enjoying, you know, the mess that it has become. Because what, you know, when I was away, obviously we had Gerard Crockwell, who had been the stalking horse for so long, announcing that he wasn't going to participate. And then you saw quite a number of interviews by Gavin Duffy, which he didn't necessarily come off the better of. You know, in particular, Hugh O'Connell did a really good interview with him in the Sunday Business Post.
It was, if anybody who hasn't read it, I'd recommend that they go and have a listen to it, or have a read of it, rather.
Absolutely. It was just, I mean, the Business Post do those things very well. You know, they do questions and answers, but it was that moment where Gavin Duffy, having a couple of lines previously, said that he would run a transparent and open campaign, then asked to go off the record when they were discussing the issue of Dennis O'Brien. And he also did an interview, I think it was with John Lee in the Mail on Sunday, but it wasn't the Mail on Sunday, and he said, you know, I'm going to take my €325,000 salary, you know, Michael D. Higgins doesn't. So for a PR guru, he hasn't necessarily been very PR savvy, but I think, you know, Gallagher is watching, I would imagine, with interest from the sidelines, and I think we could potentially see.
So, to me, looking at this from outside, Sean Gallagher, Gavin Duffy, and Padraig O'Kady look as if they'd be kind of swimming in the same fish tank in terms of the type of candidates they are. They're business
middle-aged people. Businessmen.
Yeah, middle-aged businessmen, basically.
But curiously enough, just speaking to people close to Michael D, the one candidate they don't fear, but the one candidate they believe could cause them difficulty is Gallagher. They are watching to see if he comes on the pitch, because they looked at the vote he got in the border counties the last time in particular. It was extremely high. And they think that he may have a strong card to play, in that there perhaps could be a sense that, although it is 7 years, a long time, and that may have been his moment and it passed, that someone said to me, yeah, look, Gallagher could come out and say, hey, I was the first victim of fake news. You know,
yeah, and
which he was, and he could play into that, like, no, well, your man was hard done by, and the Shooner stood him down. And I think there is a fear that, like, that if he is to come on the pitch, that he will be the main challenger to Michael D, and that of all them, like, his skeletons have been, or his cupboards have been well and truly, you know, emptied of skeletons. So that
sure
process won't apply this time, where he went through the ringer and everybody went through his business accounts. It'll happen to a certain extent, but it's unlikely to happen again this time.
I'm sure he's sitting at home as well thinking, what if, you know, in 2011 it looked, you know, it looked possible, very likely at times, that he could be the next president. And then
he was leading in the polls quite comfortably.
Yeah. Well, they've done some polling, and they believe that it kind of supports the theory that no harm to run, you know. Yeah.
And meanwhile, bubbling way below the surface in Fianna Fáil, there's the occasional kind of rumbling about Eamon O'Caoimh wanting to reverse the decision of the parliamentary party. You reporting that today?
Yeah, I think, like, O'Caoimh is just, it's hard to grasp that man. Like, basically, he isn't, again, another person who's not answering phone calls or texts from anybody. He has a local councillor out, you know, making periodic statements about Eamon wants to run for the presidency. He initially wants to go down the county council route. Now he wants to go to the parliamentary party and wants to discuss at their special away day in Malahide next month, which wouldn't be great for Micheál Martin, because the parliamentary party away days are generally the way of putting the best foot forward before the Dáil term. You're in a constituency where you hope a candidate will get elected. You want to top of your messaging. And if he's to have a big row behind closed doors about whether they stand a presidential candidate, will not be good for Fianna Fáil. I suspect, like, one part of me thinks that Eamon O'Caoimh will appear in a radio station in early September and go, what was all the fuss about? Where did all that come from? I had nothing to do with it. So he's deniability. I think it's just Eamon O'Caoimh trying to have a row with Micheál Martin, really. And there's that leftover bitterness from the referendum, that people who may be supporting O'Caoimh will be the people who went against Micheál Martin and campaigned to retain the Eighth Amendment. Just that lingering bitterness in the party that hasn't been healed.
Yeah, and I think there's obviously a bitterness between Eamon O'Caoimh and Micheál Martin, since, you know, Eamon O'Caoimh was sacked as deputy leader way back when. But I think for Micheál Martin, he has he has a calling card in saying that O'Queeve was at the two meetings in which this issue was discussed and never said a word.
That point has been made, I think, yeah.
And I think he's quite enjoying, you know, being mentioned in this. And I think maybe next time round he'll probably put himself forward.
Everything I hear you saying is the whole thing sounds like a ginormous vanity exercise. Okay. Such and such is quite enjoying being in the news. Yeah. Such and such is quite happy that there's such in the polls. It just sounds like such a load of nonsense.
Vanity politicians is not a
factor to be discounted in my experience.
It's not a surprise to Fia Garai, but if you read Miriam's column before when she did her awards, I just thought it was superb because there's something has got into a lot of these people who believe that they're worthy of the highest office in the land. And you look at some of the candidates and you're going to yourself, I mean, it's the highest office in the land, it's the most senior role, you're out there on an international level representing Ireland, and you just wonder how these people sitting at home of a Friday night with a bottle of wine.
You get up
with
in the morning, you look yourself in the mirror and you go, do you know what? I could do it too.
I am worth it.
Well, I know that Gavin Duffy and others run away from this comparison as quickly as possible, but we have an example across the Atlantic of somebody who said, I'm a successful businessman, put my best foot forward on entertainment television, therefore I can lead this country, or I can be the symbol of this country.
In 2011, no one would have said that Sean Gallagher would have ran Michael D. Higgins as close as he did. Like, arguably, he was of a similar profile. Most people are going, who is this guy? Apart from, he has a previous connection with Fianna Fáil, he was involved in Dragon's Den. Yet, he got momentum behind him. So perhaps we shouldn't be too hasty in discounting certain people and saying they won't be contenders in a month and a half's time.
Right, fair enough. Sinn Féin are definitely going to put a candidate forward. Mm-hmm. Almost certainly going to be Leah Na Rida.
Yeah, well, if I was a betting woman, that's where I'd put my money. I think the party leadership believes that it should be a female, and they believe that it should be someone within, I suppose, the parliamentary party fold. And I think Na Rida ticks all those boxes. She also understood, did a very lengthy interview with Marion Finucane, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and the party leadership were very happy with it, even though it seemed a lot of people were questioning some of the points that she raised. But the party leadership believed it was a very lengthy interview and they were quite happy with
it. Yeah, it was a good
performed.
Interview. I don't know if probably some of our listeners heard it. I thought Marion Finucane did a pretty good job on it and kind of addressed some of the things. I mean, I think the most contentious issue was the way that Sinn Féin had its own parallel separate commemorations in 1916, and how would that apply if there was a Sinn Féin president when we come to the treaty and the Civil War and all the rest of it.
And I think the party leadership felt that if she could answer those sort of questions under a sustained, lengthy interview, that she could survive a very brutal presidential campaign. I mean, from Sinn Féin's perspective, it's sort of a win-win. You know, they have an open field. They have a candidate which I think, you know, most of them would privately acknowledge may not win the next presidential campaign, but they will give Sinn Féin...
It's a good marketing platform. They're the only party officially with a candidate in the field out of the...
But also bear in mind, you know, the last presidential election, it was Martin McGuinness who stood for Sinn Féin, who had obviously a very checkered history and past, whereas Linda Rida could potentially represent something new for Sinn Féin. And that's the image that Mary Lou MacDonald wants to have in a presidential election. I don't want to say a clean candidate, but you catch my drift. They want somebody who is free of that sort of baggage and that history. And she ticks all those boxes.
Okay, on that basis, it sounds like it's a pretty dull presidential campaign coming up, and it's a foregone conclusion, Fiacre. Am I wrong?
I wouldn't say you're right. Well, I think at this stage you'd have to say Michael D is odds-on favourite, unless we get a late entry into the race by Sean Gallagher or somebody else that would kind of add a bit of excitement maybe to it. But at this stage it looks like it's going to be a curious campaign, and I think Michael D will set the tempo for it. How he decides to engage and how he decides to campaign is going to basically set the way the rest of it progresses. But I don't think it'll be as, you know, helter-skelter as it was 7 years ago when we had a cast of thousands running for an office that was wide open because Mary McAleese had done two terms. It's going to be a one-of-its-kind campaign, I'd say, because you've never really had this before. Mm. Well, we had it with De Valera in 66. That was a different era. This is a modern age. It's going to be curious to see how it plays out.
Well, I suppose now the Leaving Cert is out today. The Rose of Tralee will be kicking off in a week's time. Electric Picnic is on the horizon, and the politicians will be back pretty soon, Sarah.
We hope so, yeah. Otherwise it's going to make for a long August for Fiacre and I. But look, I actually think the presidential is going to be great crack, because as Fiacre said, we haven't had a presidential campaign like this. I mean, you know, are we actually going to have a sitting president debate the likes of Gavin Duffy and Joan Freeman on prime time. Like, you know, I mean, it's going to be fascinating.
He isn't going to run away from debates and interviews, so we are likely to see Gavin Duffy versus Michael D. Higgins versus Leany Reid if it is her, and in an RT studio, or maybe in this studio even, if we ask them.
Still my beating heart.
In fairness, that could potentially damage Michael D. Higgins, because people see him as this, you know, they have an image of Michael D. Higgins, you know, with the dogs.
So it's his to lose. There's an element of that.
And Michael D., like, you know, he has this image over the last 7 years of the elder statesman living in the park. Michael D. is a pretty bare-knuckle political fighter he wants to be, and there's probably people who haven't seen that, and it'll be interesting to see how they react to that, as Sarah says, if he's in an RT studio, and they'll all be out to get him. They'll all be poking him to make him try and react, you know, just the fiery old Michael D., who should call, I think he called that guy, that American guy, a wanker down the line one time.
Yeah.
In a news talk show, does that guy reappear?
It's sounding more and more like a Seinfeld show. Fiat, Sarah, thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Inside Politics. Thanks to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, and our engineer, Philip Brady. Remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast provider may be. You can also find us at irishtimes.com/podcasts. Your views are always very welcome. You can mail me at hlinahan@irishtimes.com, or you can always find me on Twitter. But until the next time, goodbye, and thanks very much indeed for listening.